Hello, you are listening to Prof Talk on UBC CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Welcome to Prof Talk. I'm your host, Farha Khan. There's no question we know a lot more about AIDS today than in the years past. It was once believed that HIV, if transmitted, meant a sure and relatively rapid death. But today, so much of that thinking has changed. Today, I have the extraordinary pleasure of having one of the top AIDS researchers in the world right here in Studio CITR. Dr. Julio Montaner is the director of the British Columbia Center for Excellence in HIV/AIDS, the chair in AIDS research and head of division of AIDS in the Faculty of Medicine at UBC. He's also the past president of the International AIDS Society. His recent research has been primarily focused on the implementation of the Seek and Treat for Optimal Prevention of HIV/AIDS initiative, which will utilize HIV treatment as an HIV prevention strategy in BC. The initiative seeks to drastically decrease HIV-related morbidity and mortality in the province. Dr. Julio Montaner joins me now here in studio in CITR. Thank you, Julio, for coming in today.
Thank you, Farah, for coming here.
You were born and raised in Argentina, and we were talking about that before we started. And you came to Canada in 1981, fresh out of medical school. You are now one of the top AIDS researchers in the world. Tell us about this incredible journey.
Well, it's been nothing but an exceptional life-changing story. I was privileged to grow up in Buenos Aires, a city that I love, a country that I also love very much. And I had every intention to stay in Buenos Aires and be hopefully a mover and shaker in the healthcare field back at home. My dad was a very prominent physician, and so I had a fair bit of inspiration coming that way. At the same time, because of the privileged situation that I had, I wanted to earn my stripes, so to speak, elsewhere. And I was looking for a place where I could train and really forge my career before I could claim my seat next to my dad and hopefully have an impact back at home. And I went to a number of places looking for mentors, and everywhere I was received by a friend of my father, it was something that a bit disappointing. I was trying to escape his sort of umbrella, and I realized his umbrella was much bigger than I anticipated. And it wasn't until I met Professor Hogg from UBC at St. Paul's Hospital that I managed to get an opportunity to train somewhere where my dad was actually not known. Escaping his area of influence, I came to Vancouver. I was very fortunate that I was coming to a great place, both academically and everything else, really, for that matter. And within months of arriving here, one step at a time, my life was changing in front of my eyes. It was 3 months into it that Professor Hall came back to me and said that he was planning to offer me to stay for another year at a time in which I didn't even know what I was doing. So it was very early on. I was flattered, and I decided that I would do that. And then shortly thereafter, he started to talk to me about how important it would be that I complete my training based on sort of Canadian standards so that I could go back home and really be well-formed and rounded and have a real impact. And little did I know that while all of this was happening, I met my wife, Dorothy, and that was late in 81 already, and so everything was falling apart in front of my eyes. And, you know, one thing led to the other. At the same time, there was an epidemic brewing that I knew nothing about. And in fact, I didn't even know I was getting involved with it. My original focus was respiratory medicine, because pneumonia, a very severe lethal pneumonia, was the main reason why people with HIV were falling ill and eventually dying. I became interested in this problem, and lo and behold, we came up with a strategy. We managed to treat it effectively to prevent death. By 1985, I was immersed in HIV, like 100%, and there was no way turning back.
You've often been described as someone who's incredibly passionate about the work that you do. Do you think that's why you've been so successful in your career?
Yeah, I think what happens is that you feed from the people that you're working with. You feed from the energy that you receive from the patients that you're working with, and being Latin, that also helps. I bring a bit of a different level of emotion to the stuff that I do. I've been always very sort of socially minded, if you want, in terms of I was very perturbed back at home with inequalities and disparities, if you want, in terms of social issues and the like, and that always troubled me quite a bit. And so as I became involved in HIV, I wasn't totally aware of all of the issues. I mean, this was a total new world for me. But as I say, feeding from the energy that my patients brought to the table, I picked up where they left, and I tried to champion their issues. How can you not be passionate and committed when so many young people, they put their life on the line to help you find out the answers to the sometimes very important life-changing research that we were able to conduct here? So that has been a huge motivation. And then as you learn more and you further appreciate the insights that you have gained and the tremendous contribution that knowledge can make to society, and yet then you appreciate what I call the implementation gap. I mean, all of the stuff that we know that we could do and we are not doing because of indifference or political apathy or simply the fact that there are preconceived biases and notions that preclude us from doing the right thing, then all of that feeds you even further. And so my whole professional life has evolved into one of, yes, science, but also activism in trying to close that implementation gap so that hopefully we can all benefit from implementing to this maximum everything we know so that we can have soon an AIDS-free generation.
So right now there are more than 33 million people that are affected with HIV, and most of them are in sub-Saharan Africa. And although there is no cure for AIDS, it's no longer considered a death sentence, mostly because of greater access to these antiretroviral drugs. Tell us about how you have helped to create a triple drug therapy that's now the gold standard treatment for HIV today.
Well, with all due respect, because I don't mean this in a bad way, but I look at my work as being a combination of good luck, fortunate insights, dedication, hard work, and commitment. I don't think that I'm smarter than anybody else, or that I know something unique that nobody else knows. But it's a matter of drawing parallels between what you know and what you're trying to solve. So most of the work that we have done in HIV draws directly from the experience of tuberculosis, which is the area that my father was working back at home. And so I tried to adapt a lot of the stuff that that my dad was working with onto the field of HIV. There were a lot of parallels in my mind all along. And I remember back in the day having these discussions with him about the fact that, you know, maybe earlier treatment would be more useful and maybe combining drugs maybe the way to go. And so, you know, we started to do more and more and more of those sort of clinical trials and research. And eventually, and really because this particular drug was being abandoned by the Americans because they felt that it was not good enough, I had the opportunity to test this new drug, nevirapine at the time, as part of a triple drug combination therapy, a novel approach at the time. It had not been treated or used before. And so in a very sort of exploratory way, we were able to secure funding by Boehringer Ingelheim, the company that had that drug, to help us do this research. The company actually was so disconcerted by the lack of success in the previous trials that they were ready to dump the whole thing. And I said, no, let's do this. And of course, it took a lot of work and a lot of convincing, but we managed to convince them. And we started this pilot study. And a year later, that was December 1995, one of the senior virologists in Canada, Mark Weinberg, a good friend of mine from Montreal, the Jewish General Hospital, I remember him calling me aside. He was doing the virology for our study and saying, Julio, there's something wrong with your study because all of a sudden we don't seem to be able to grow the virus. I'm just giving you the sense that in retrospect, I could rewrite history and say that we had tremendous insight and we planned the discovery of triple therapy. But the reality is, you know, we were trying this and that and the other thing, and we were lucky on this particular one. And at the time that we were lucky that the virus was not growing, we actually were not sure if it was a therapeutic success or we had messed up the whole thing. So a new set of experiments were done. Yes, we confirm in December 1995 that triple therapy given de novo to people who had never been treated, who were infected with HIV, could suppress the replication of the virus, which in turn, by stopping the replication of the virus, allowed the immunity to recover and therefore prevented the immune deficiency related complications. In other words, prevented death, allowed people to live longer. And in 1996, when we announced these results at the Vancouver conference in town, we were able to tell the world, look, there is a new way to do this. If we treat people with triple therapy, we will transform HIV from a rapidly progressive lethal disease into a chronic manageable condition. And, you know, it wasn't perfect right away, but we were pretty close to being right 100%. Very soon, triple therapy became the standard of care, and within months, death rates in British Columbia almost melted in front of our eyes. It was the most dramatic experience in my life.
Wow. And so over the course of this time, arguably millions of lives have been saved.
Yeah, I mean, highly active antiretroviral therapy, which we now know is the standard of care for the world, is based on the triple drug combination that we unveiled in Vancouver in 1996. And of course, there were a number of others that contributed to this new knowledge. But collectively, this group of investigators, we had the, I guess, the privilege of bringing something that was truly transformational. The fight then became to make it so that heart could be embraced in the south of the world, where the epidemic was really thriving. I mean, 90% of the cases were in the south of the world, where less than 10% of the people had access to medication. So it was a very challenging situation. And it was kind of difficult for us coming from the north to argue that the south should be doing this when, you know, resources were a problem. But at the end of the day, we got the World Health Organization to rally behind it. We got funders to rally behind it. And the so-called 3x5 program was instituted. The aim was to have 3 million people on antiretroviral therapy by 2005. It was a very modest aim. At the time, people felt that it was something that would never happen. And yes, guess what? It took a bit longer. By 2007, 3 million people were on antiretroviral therapy, and we now have nearly tripled that number, which very good results, all in the south of the world, saving lives, saving families, putting people back on their feet, back to work, and really making a huge difference. Is it enough? It's not enough. But have we began to change the nature of the epidemic and the course of the epidemic. Yes, we have. So we need to work harder now.
Now, this therapy can drive the viral load of people living with HIV to undetectable levels, making their risk of transmitting the virus to partners extraordinarily low. How does this treatment reduce the amount of virus in the bodily fluids of someone with the HIV infection?
Well, you see, what happens is that when you stop the replication of the virus, the sort of vacuum cleaner that we all have within ourselves, the reticuloendothelial system, starts cleaning up the virus that you have circulating. So in a matter of 3 weeks, 3 months, or 6 months, it doesn't matter, it takes a few weeks, but at the end of the day, within a period of about 3 to 6 months, the virus in your blood becomes undetectable. So you basically shut down viral replication, you clean up the virus that was present, and as long as you're taking the medication properly, then there is no longer detectable virus in your blood. As that's happening, the virus also becomes undetectable in other biological fluids, whether it's semen or cervicovaginal fluid or rectal mucosa, you name it. And as a result of that, we hypothesized back a number of years ago that if the amount of virus in a biological fluid was the main driver of HIV transmission from one person to another, regardless of the setting, whether it's mother-to-child transmission, injection drug user transmission, sexual transmission, it's always the same. The more virus in the infected person, the higher the likelihood that you're going to transmit. So if that is the case, well, the opposite should be true. Less virus, less transmission. And no virus, hopefully, we argued, could mean that the likelihood of transmission would go down, 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 down to almost a negligible level. Now, we came out with the statement back in 2006. It was a fairly controversial situation. Ended up being a Lancet paper, plenary at the International AIDS Conference in Toronto. So it happens that we were changing guards in Canada from the Liberal to the Conservative government. So that brought me no few enemies in the federal government as well. But at the end of the day, I'm happy to tell you that thanks to the unwavering support of the government of British Columbia, we actually were able to explore this issue at a populational level in BC, demonstrating that by expanding the coverage with antiretroviral therapy among the people infected with HIV, not only we were able to decrease morbidity and mortality, putting people back to work, keeping them at home, and so on and so forth, but also we were able to control transmission of HIV, so that in BC today, virtually, thanks to the use of the treatment, we have no more mother-to-child transmission of HIV. Number one, we have virtually eliminated mother-to-child transmission of HIV. And secondly, we have had a 60% reduction in the number of HIV new diagnoses from a high of, say, in the order of 900 prior to 1996 to the current level, 2010 is the last figure that I have for you, of 301 diagnosed cases in 2010. If you can imagine, that means that every year we're sparing ourselves some 600 or so new HIV infections. The trend continues to improve. We are dramatically decreasing morbidity, dramatically decreasing mortality. We are keeping people employed. We're keeping people at home. We are protecting the family. And at the end of the day, we're saving money. So there is nothing here that you could say I don't like. I mean, this is actually remarkable. Now, in order for these programs to be implemented effectively and successfully, we need to deal with other issues that affect people that are at most risk with HIV. And that's where the challenge comes.
Last year, the magazine Science and Time named this treatment, or the treatment as prevention model, the breakthrough of the year for 2011. How did that make you feel?
Well, to be perfectly candid, we've been asking for this to be named the breakthrough of the year now for close to a decade, but finally came. No, just kidding. Really what precipitated the international community to finally truly embrace treatment as prevention was that the Americans completed a randomized controlled trial where heterosexual couples, in other words, couples, sexually active couples, a man and a woman, where one was HIV positive and the other not, regardless of who was what. These couples were sexually active. They were counseled to use condoms and the like. But over and above that, they were randomly assigned, half of them to do nothing else, the other half to receive HIV treatment immediately. So the HIV-infected member of the couple was told, look, in your situation, we wouldn't typically recommend treatment. I'll remind you, this is for Africa, so usually they use treatment very late for our liking, but nonetheless, they took advantage of that sort of delaying of treatment in the African context for the most part, and they said, look, we're going to give you treatment earlier to see what it does to HIV transmission primarily. Well, interestingly, by treating people early, they showed a decrease of 41% in morbidity and mortality. So along the study was able to again show that earlier treatment is significantly better for the person who is infected. But over and above that, what they show was a 96% reduction on HIV transmission. 96%. I mean, it doesn't get much better than that. The statistics, just to give you an idea, or the rate was derived from one case of HIV transmission among the serodiscordant couples that would receive treatment, and that couple transmitted the transmission event occurred within days or weeks of starting the treatment. So the treatment did not have a chance to become active. As I said earlier, it takes a few days or weeks, maybe a few months sometimes, for the virus to become undetectable. So if you start the treatment, the treatment doesn't protect you from transmitting until it takes full effect in, say, three to six months. So what that means is that if you allow the treatment to become effective, truly it becomes nearly 100% effective. This is huge because it now says that the decision of whether or not to deliver on the promise of an AIDS-free generation is on us. We have no excuses. We don't need to wait for a vaccine. We don't need to wait for a cure. We don't need to wait for the second coming of Jesus. We have the tools and we have them here. And if we don't do it, it's because we don't want it. Now, we want it if our political leaders deliver on the promise, which, by the way, has been done at the highest possible level at the United Nations, including the government of Canada, to deliver on universal access to care, treatment, and prevention for the south of the world. If we do that, we will stop HIV. And we haven't because they promised it, but they didn't put the money to do the trick.
And that's what you always say, that we have to stop writing guidelines and really, really start implementing them.
Right. I mean, I've been at the forefront of writing guidelines all my life. And to be perfectly honest, and I have tremendous respect for the guidelines, tremendous respect for the process behind them and the science behind it and everything else. But if I take my scientific hat off for a minute and I tell you the truth, we could stop writing guidelines today, we could stop making promises today, deliver on the guidelines that we have and the promises that we have already made, and if we do that, we will have a different world within our lifetime.
Are you optimistic?
Well, I've always been optimistic, but more than optimistic, I am committed to make it happen. And I will do whatever it takes to make my contribution meaningful to this fight. And if I had to face Mr. Harper face to face, I will do it.
Have you, what is your, besides meeting these politicians, what is really your next big project with your current research?
Well, my ambition in the short term is to demonstrate at the field level, using the province of British Columbia as the sort of major laboratory opportunity that we have in front of us, to demonstrate that by fully exploiting this strategy, we can drive HIV to very, very low levels, both at the individual level in terms of disease progression and mortality, which we're doing already, and also at the societal level by the stopping transmission. My second priority is to address all of the determinants of HIV that we can possibly address, whether it is the decriminalization of drugs, the normalization of HIV care and testing, the the normalization of the commercial sex work trade so that we can have a society where we can approach these issues in a much more constructive way. We made a lot of progress with the fight for recognition of the gay people in our community. We are not finished with that, but if we could bring all of the rest of the pieces of the puzzle to that kind of level of functioning, that would be great. And finally, what I want to do is to show that the approach that we have used for HIV in terms of the quasi-elimination of an epidemic can actually be exported to other areas of medicine. And currently, I am promoting the extrapolation of our work to the area of hepatitis C, for example, where we honestly believe that if we use the seek and treat approach, finding people infected, treating them aggressively, appropriately and aggressively, we can actually control not just the HIV epidemic, but many other such epidemics that are affecting our world.
It's been such an incredible pleasure to have you here, and thank you so much for taking the time out of your very busy schedule, I'm sure, to be here with us.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much.
I've just been speaking with Dr. Julio Montaner, the director of the British Columbia Center for Excellence in HIV/AIDS. For more information about his research, please visit www.cfenet.ubc.ca. You are listening to Prof Talk on UBC CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver and via live web streaming on CITR.ca. Next week, I will speak with Dr. Detrich Jung, a UBC Green College visiting scholar from the Center for Contemporary Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Southern Denmark. If you would like to hear a podcast of this show or any previous episode of Prof Talk, please visit proftalk.ubc.ca or email us at prof.talk@ubc.ca. I'm your host, Farah Khan. Thank you for listening today. We'll be right back.